Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are teaching Americans to persuade Americans, de-persuade Americans, counter-persuade, you name it. It seems like we need some training. Complicated times out there require sophisticated techniques. We're coming at you from the intersection of politics, rhetoric, and comedy. An unusual intersection, but that's my street corner. You can find us on social media. I tweet jokes all day long at Rhetoric War. If you're into some comedy with your politics, a couple from today, I think that paying to rent a documentary on Karl Marx seems a little wrong. I almost did that this weekend. I was like, hey, this doesn't seem right. And also just a reminder, there's a guy worth $20 million who's already got the vaccine and has decided y'all don't need a one-time $2,000 check. So the man who, currently vying for the most hated man in America, Mitch McConnell, from my home state of Kentucky. So think about Mitch, see how he makes you feel. I am Dr. Dan French. I'm an American rhetorician. I have a PhD in rhetoric, escaped professor. Also a stand-up comedian, long time, and comedy writer from late night TV in Hollywood. This podcast does three things. We talk to comedians about their politics. Always fun to hear what those brains see. And we find persuasion pros to talk about the secrets of persuasion from many different vantage points. And finally, I like to get people on here who have a different political viewpoint than I do. And sometimes I even try to convert people. But it's really about giving people more tools for talk. Persuasion and politics really shouldn't infuriate other people. It just means that you haven't really been trained yet on how to do it right. So that's part of my goal, is to give you some of those tools. You can visit us at rhetoricwarriors.com, take our one-year master course in persuasion for people who want to get others to do what they want them to do. That's my promise. So this week, a very interesting guy I've known for a few months now. We've done some work together. And I'm going to list him as Tom from Tacoma, even though his last name is not from Tacoma. But every once in a while, when I do politics on here, I think when people come from the real world, as opposed to my sort of entertainment or public world, you know, it's good to give people a little bit of cover. Politics has gotten very aggro these days. So I encourage my guests to take a little bit of cover so that they feel like they can say whatever they want to say. My guest today, Tom from Tacoma, is a tech executive, long time, super interesting history, kind of an amateur historian, I would think. Seems to be very interested in reading and actually getting some information, some perspective that applies these days. Really smart guy. Welcome, Tom from Tacoma. Tom, what's up?
Thanks, Dan. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, and we've teched this already, so it's going to be clean because we're both super techie and great with Zoom, and you just, you know. It's funny, working in Hollywood production for as long as I did, the fact that I'm sitting at a IKEA-bought table with a pretty cool boom microphone, and just hoping it all works, because I'm the whole tech department. It's a little different.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I love the boom microphone, and I'm definitely going to be getting one of those. I like it for the look, because I'm spending all of my time on Zoom calls like everybody else.
Yeah, it ups your game, man. Like, you instantly gather some credibility from having that boom there. It's the only professional part of this setup, so.
No, it looks fantastic.
So,
and it sounds better.
So run your background for us just a little bit, sort of just orient us to kind of who Tom from Tacoma is.
Father of four, 18, 16, 13, and 10. Oof. The oldest are away at a boarding school, which has been a complete surprise and shock to me. I don't have any experience with that in my life. Grew up in Florida, moved to Texas in the early 80s. My dad was coming out here to start a company in the offshore oil engineering business just as oil crashed.
Nice. And,
I remember the bumper stickers in Houston that said, "Oh God, please give us one more oil boom. And we promise this time we won't piss it all away."
Moved to Texas. Austin, that's the history of Texas.
What's that?
So that's the history of Texas, right? Boom and bust.
History of the oil business, for sure. Anyway, so about me, went to University of Texas and got an electrical engineering degree. Got out and went right into sales and sales, enterprise sales, selling microprocessors and helped making the PC business happen.
That was right at the core of one of the like big, you know, American capitalist waves, right?
It was. It was an amazing thing to be part of. And the company I was at was just spectacular and really a great place to learn. And, you know, founders were still there and it was, you know, a big, you know, turned into a big company. Was sure that the PCs were going to be overshadowed by what I was calling the mobile internet access device, and got into the low power processor space and helped make some PDAs happen. And then eventually got into the mobile phone space. And we were a big part of making the smartphone business happen. So that was another kind of huge wave that I was blessed to be part of.
And yeah, you talk about like the things that determine, you know, human existence in the world today. Those are two of them.
Yeah. Well, I feel good about the PC space. I feel like in hindsight now that the smartphones, based on, you know, the amount of time, I mean, they're super useful, but they're also just complete, you know, brain drains, I think. And people spend a lot of time on their smartphone when they could be interacting with other people. So I feel a little guilty about my work in there.
Yeah, it says smartphones, right? It says nothing about the smart user.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
smartphone dumb user.
Exactly. So anyway, I was in the smartphone business right at the beginning and helped make that happen. And then I got interested in, and I'd always wanted to be at startups, left the big company, went to a startup based in the UK, went to another one based in Israel, spent a lot of time on international flights. Really enjoyed that. I spent about 6 years at a company that I helped found and get started in the information security space, which has been you know, really interesting for me. And that's home for me now is information security.
Yeah. So it's always interesting to me. Like I, you know, went through education and I was kind of at the same time going through entertainment. It's only been in the last 5 years or so that I've moved over into, you know, the business space and realized, you know, this is probably where most of the world lives. You know, my other spaces were the minority spaces. This is a majority space of how people see the world. But that worldview of business, you know, it was so foreign to me, and I was probably 50 before I started working in it, that I've just seen it, the culture of it and the way that you know, business looks at things like sales, like persuading masses of people over to, you know, like you're talking about new technologies that, you know, maybe they've seen in science fiction, but they've never seen it in reality.
You know, yeah.
It's an interesting world.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. And I have spent essentially my career in sales and doing persuasion from a, you know, trying make the revenue. I never really saw myself as a salesperson. I think a lot of people think of sales as, you know, somebody that's selling a used car or selling shoes and just trying to get that transaction. And my world has been all business to business and enterprise and trying to convince the folks that are responsible for a company to make a bet on a product that is going to either, you know, be a big deal for them or going to wish they hadn't done it. But that kind of persuasion is wildly different from the sort of greasy sales type. And I've really enjoyed it. It turns out it was the right place for me.
Well, it's also different, I've noticed, than because part of the way we started working together is I do some help with executives to try to, you know, create a biography for them that has a little more verve maybe than what they typically do. And I bring, you know, sort of that, it's not exactly PR, but it's more celebrity factor kind of training from entertainment so that it has a little sizzle, it has a little pop, the language is a little more interesting and elevated. And I've been challenged a lot of times about bringing that down to the level where it doesn't stand out too much in business, you know, because if you go against the natives, the way the natives talk too far, then it alienates them. But if you just dangle it a little bit over the edge and they see some nice little diamonds or gems in it, then they're, you know, they're more attracted to it. It's a interesting, you know, persuasion challenge to get messages just at the right, you know, fringe of that.
Yeah, no, it's I think that's a, it's an important balance, right? You know, and for, like you were saying, that you and I started working together on me in many ways, and on my consulting business, and I think I'm pretty good at marketing and mm-hmm. positioning and key messaging when it comes to products or services, but I struggle when it comes to me. So I've been glad to have your help on putting a little more sizzle in the explanation and the background and the brand that's me.
Well, selling humans is a little different. They're a different product.
Well, selling humans will get you in trouble in most countries, but we'll just say pitching humans.
Yeah, it's a problematic verb when you get to humans. But, you know, you see people like Trump, who has grown up through promotion. You know, he was a business guy, but he was also clearly his own publicist and lived on the publicity factor to make his brand known, and has always sought that out. And he talks about himself a lot, but he does it in such super, you know, aggrandizing ways, super, you know, braggadocio and, you know, I'm so great that it's odd to hear it coming from somebody like that. But, you know, in promotion world, they'll kind of let people get away with that, but you can't talk about yourself that way in ordinary business, right?
Maybe you can. I mean, I've seen up close and personal some top tier CEOs, and some of them are just, you know, just incredibly brilliant. And others are, well, I often say that, you know, a CEO has one of the job descriptions, or one of the key sort of traits of a CEO, is they're a narcissist. Mm-hmm. You know, I said it, so it's true. And I think that's a lot of, you know, what Trump does is that sort of, I'm going to make it happen. And that's, in many ways, that's sort of the ultimate entrepreneur, right? Somebody that can say, yeah, we can do that. Look at Elon Musk. I mean, how many times has he said, yeah, we can do that? And people go, yeah, no. And it's that kind of, I think narcissism is the right word, that enables them to do what they do. And we've had, you know, incredible value created and, you know, employment created and opportunities created by people that do that. But you got to be careful, because you can also get burned and, you know, get into some ugliness there, you know, with guys with that kind of and women too, with that kind of an ego.
Yeah. And it's fascinating when I look at, you know, and I do general rhetorical analysis and look at the theories of big systems like this, like here's politics, political tradition in America, right? And then here's business talk in America, and here's PR kind of celebrity talk in America. And Trump, you know, invaded politics with business talk, like you're saying, you know, one person imbued with decision power and doesn't ever really have to sit there and, you know, convince everybody around them that they have to do exactly what they say. There's enough power in the CEO that people are trying to convince the CEO. It's not the other way around. You know, so he imported business talk and he imported PR talk into politics, and it just blew politics open. You know, they really had no idea how to deal with it. And people still don't. You know, you still, it's the same indictments that they hit him with about with traditional politics, about he's lying, or you can't trust what he says, or, you know, well, that's all natural in PR. You know, you always overclaim, but but it just doesn't, it's so unnatural in politics that people don't know what to deal with it. They don't know how to deal with it yet.
Yeah, Trump's done some pretty amazing things. I mean, love him or hate him, you know, I'm not a lover or a hater, for the record.
Really, you're neutral about Trump.
There's a lot about Trump that I just don't like. But there's also, you know, you got to give him credit on the order of sort of Reagan or Clinton or Obama. In terms of the changes that he's brought to politics, right? I mean, I think to me, Reagan was the guy that brought together the the economic conservatives with the social conservatives, right? And that was an interesting alliance that still, to some extent, is still around, right?
Sure.
And by the way, Reagan was a Democrat.
Reagan was a Democrat. Now, that's what we got into this because you started making statements like that.
I think
Trump was a Democrat.
Trump, in my spectrum, you know, Trump is sort of a more fiscally conservative Democrat, but, you know, an old school, you know, Rockefeller wing Republican, which is, you know, a Democrat to me. But the reason I was bringing Trump up and I was saying, look, Reagan did some incredible things. Bill Clinton, an incredible persuader, right? Incredible. He was successful despite his wife, right? Although I remember, like, you know, lots of jokes about that. But Obama really brought a tech sort of social media savvy to elections and to turning out people that I don't think had been done before. But I think what Trump really did was disintermediate the media, right? I mean, he discovered that he didn't have to have sound bites. He didn't have to have, you know, pay attention to the news cycle. He didn't, you know, it was all about just communicating directly in, you know,
he weaponized police. Twitter for sure.
And by Twitter, yeah. You know, and the Twitter guys hate him, but, you know, what's he done for their business? I mean, it's got to be incredible what he's done for their business, right?
I'm curious about that. Like, you know, ultimately, the businesses like that will, you know, they live or die on the same type of judgments that people make about all businesses, about is this a moral business or an immoral business, right? That's one of the major judgments we have about businesses and corporations that, you know, like cigarettes. For a long time, cigarettes were, you know, they were fine. And then when they took a huge moral, you know, torpedo to the hull, and, you know, ever since then, like, they've got a moral stain on them, a huge one. And Twitter, before Trump came along, you know, I don't think was seen as a right-wing platform or a way for a guy, you know, with, you know, depending on where you're at on this, totalitarian instincts to gain power. So I think Twitter is now morally compromised as a space for a lot of people.
Well, I would argue that Twitter is morally compromised themselves by exercising censorship, right? And I think Trump was spot on with trying to get their exemption removed, because they've taken a position, right? And once you've taken a position, then you're responsible for the content. So I'm not.
But they've always taken a position, right? They've always restricted content. They won't allow super violent content, super sexualized content. They won't hate speech, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, that. I agree. There's been some boundaries, but they've moved the goalposts significantly over the last, you know, 4 years, and in an attempt to kind of take away from Trump the tool that he, you know, sort of created in many ways, which was, I'm going to talk directly to the electorate.
Well, he can still do that. It just doesn't have to go over Twitter.
He can still?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's got the bully pulpit, right? That's the ultimate. I can communicate directly. But he also, you know, I think shone a light on the regular and existing media in a way that is a horrible look for him, right? It's like, you know, everybody in the media is like, well, we're impartial, right? We're the fourth, we call it the fourth.
Fourth column, estate, yeah.
The fourth estate, and they're clearly not. They're you know, the media is partisan. And by the way, the media's been partisan forever, right? I mean, you know, the second election that we had, second or third election for president, you know, Jefferson was one of the wealthiest guys in the country, and he owned the newspapers, and he could buy, you know, the ability to communicate, and he just hammered Adams, mm-hmm, in ways that I'm surprised that they eventually got to be friends again. But, you know, that the media has always been, you know, very biased. And I think, and you know, that's human. But when you claim you're not biased, I think that's dirty. right?
So let's talk about that, because this is a super important concept, and I see it a lot. I see it bandied about, you know, a lot. And Trump did, you know, use the media as his straw man, you know, as a villain, as a foil, yeah, which is a, you know, that's a very common propaganda technique in totalitarian regimes to go after the media. And I don't think America had ever heard this kind of a vehement attack about its media, right?
Maybe in the last, maybe since sort of radio, they haven't. But I think before that, they probably did. You know, the media was, I'm not sure I'm going to buy that premise exactly, but let's go last 100 years. That's good.
That's why I say an amateur historian, when you expand it all the way, you know, back to Adams and Jefferson, and you start making, you know, like I make a claim about the media, you're like, well, the media was the newspaper back then. And that's a weird equivalency to think, you know, like a few newspapers that existed at the time of the colonials are equal to this massive, you know, uncontrollable conglomerate of social media and digital and everything else. Like what this has become is just such a massive jungle of pipelines, you know, shoots directly into people's minds. Yeah. You know, so many of them that there's no way to control all of that, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think they've done a pretty good job of controlling it. I mean, I think there's probably, you know, the two most evil companies in all of human history, and there's been some evil companies, right, are in my mind, Google and Facebook.
Really? So let's talk about it. Cause like I said, you know, industries bring a generalized moral judgment about them. And you've just given me one that I've not heard. I've heard of, you know, people going after Facebook recently, but it's mostly, you know, because of the selling of data mining to the right with, you know, Cambridge Analytica, you know, and, you know, the fact that they're protecting Trump. That's what I hear a lot of, you know, through the media. So tell me why you would stain those two companies.
I think they are, I've always been, and this is, you know, one of the things I liked about Reagan, right? I mean, he had faith in people, right? And I think our system is based on assuming that people can take care of themselves and know best for themselves, right? And when some person, you were talking about totalitarian governments, right? When somebody knows better for me than I do, that's a big red flag, right? So I don't need somebody to filter news and tell me whether it's fake or not. I can figure that out, right? And I think everybody else can figure that out.
Really? You think everybody else is equally as intelligent and perceptive as you are?
I think there's people that are much smarter than me. I think that you are a sovereign being, and you get to decide for yourself. And if you're not making good decisions for yourself, then you're, you know, it used to be you were beaten out of the gene pool pretty quickly. right. And I mean, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, 300 years ago for sure, but, you know, 2 million years of humanity, you got beat out of the gene pool if you weren't making good decisions for yourself. Right.
And yeah, but we got rid of evolution long ago. We don't live in an evolutionary cycle anymore.
I agree. But I do think that it's important that people make their own decisions. You know, and if you want to sign up and let somebody else make decisions for you, that's fine. But I don't want to be signed up, right? And Google and Facebook are in a position where they are controlling the agenda and the topics. Mm-hmm. In ways that are insidious. You know, if you want to find out what kind of an echo chamber you're really in, get a VPN, get a fresh computer, a fresh browser, and do some Google searches. And you will find that you're getting a very targeted bit of information. You know, when you do a Google search, you're not getting what Google and Alta Vista and you know, pick one of the early search engines where they were just trying to provide a tool, right? What, you know, Google's the biggest advertising company ever, right? And they are all about, from a business perspective, and good for them, making sure that they can do the right things for their customers, which are people that are selling stuff, whether it's selling politics or selling, you know, products, right? But they've really got their kind of finger on the scales in ways that it's hard to measure and hard to see. And I think you've seen a lot of that. And, you know, in the last election, the last two elections, you know, they were pretty aggressive about cutting whole sort of areas of discussion out because it didn't fit with their worldview. And when somebody's making those decisions for me about what information I can get, it's the equivalent of book burning, but you don't need a fire to burn digital books or to burn digital information. You just have to have your finger on the scale there. And it's amazing what you can do with just a little bit of your finger on the scale.
Sure. And I think there's tons of, you know, when you look at the communication trail, right, from here's an idea that I want to communicate into the world down to here are the people that are going to receive it. You know, at each stage, it goes through a lot of, you know, alteration. This is partly what I do for people in that I take them through a pipeline that's going to get them a message that's going to work with their intended target. And there's tons of decisions within that, no matter who you are. Mm-hmm. No matter whether you're Google or whether you're, you know, talking to a 5-year-old kid, you know, in your kitchen, you're adjusting your message so that it can work with that target. Right. How's that any different? Because Google can't give every message, you know, and Facebook can't give every perspective. Like it's impossible.
They're exempt from laws because they are supposed to be impartial. Right. They don't own the content. If they own the content, then they're responsible. I mean, if they filter the content, if they provide only, you know, limited perspectives, then they're responsible for the content. Right.
Right. But they have to. You have to shape. There's when you go from data, just chaotic data, right, the amount of chaotic data in the universe, and you move it down to a message. There's so much shrinkage. There's so much decision making going on there. It's uncountable. You've got to make those decisions. Like that is basic communication theory.
Right, right. Well, then let's agree that Google is filtering and is positioning and is controlling what messages come through, right? I mean, they either are or they aren't, right? And then we get into a discussion about, you know, kind of the old libertarian, the anarchist part of the Libertarian Party, right? Who it's like, I don't want to do anything for everybody else, right? And, right. And you know, then there's a, you know, on the far end of a particular spectrum, there's like, well, the state should decide everything. Somebody else should decide, right? And by the way, you got to have roads. We need roads, don't we? I'm not arguing that we don't need roads. What I'm saying is I think that, you know, the social media giants are controlling the discussion in a way that hasn't been possible before. And yes, they should be stopping child pornography from coming out, but should they be filtering, should they be affecting, you know, my right to say what I want? I mean, well, okay, so there's limits to the First Amendment, right? I can't go into a crowded movie theater and yell fire. And those are, you know, I think, you know, most people are going to agree with that. You know, can I shut down communication from somebody because I've, you know, painted them as a lunatic, or, you know, pick your sort of cancel culture word for rewriting history, right? I think you got to be really careful. And I think if you don't have faith that everybody can decide for themselves, then you're putting yourself in a spot that's, you're a deity, right? I know better than they do, so I'm going to decide for them. I think if you ever step into that, then you're really kind of getting into a slippery slope.
Well, let's break some of these apart, because I think these become conglomeration issues, you know? Yeah. So let's break that one apart, that you don't want to be a deity and decide anything for somebody else. But I, you know, come from a background like with the Greek Platonist, like Plato believed that was a good thing. Like you got people who got great training and they were good hearted. They were good people. And they, you know, filtered information down to people who didn't have that opportunity. So you have an intellectual, you know, and a moral elite in that system that gets well trained and they're good people and they really work hard to, you know, give people the type of information they need to make good decisions. And so you're saying, like, when you try to equalize everybody, I was a professor for 20 years and my direct experience is that people are not equalized intellectually. And this was with college students. These were people who were trying to get educations. And I would say 60, maybe 70% of them did not qualify intellectually for college. But, you know, college has changed and they, you know, it's a business. They try to get as many people in there as they can.
Yeah.
God bless them. But I totally see the value of having an elite, you know, perspective. Not that it has to be just elite. I also respect people's ability to, you know, determine their own fate. And I'm an independent person, but I don't trust the people like that.
That's exactly where I'm coming from. I agree with you. I don't trust people like that either. I'm not.
Well, I don't trust the people that you're talking about should be make the general people. I trust the elite people more than the general people.
Oh, I trust and distrust based on, you know, the information I've gathered, not on whether somebody else is, you know, in an elite because, you know, their parents made a lot of money or, you know, they've been a politician forever and, you know, they're.
That's power elite, right? You're talking about the power elite.
I don't know. You were talking about a more general elite.
I was talking about an intellectual and a moral elite.
Okay. Well, all right. That's interesting. You know, you talked a little bit about altruism there, right? I mean, they're good-hearted people and they're doing this filtering and providing information to their subjects because they have a good heart, right?
Yes, and, yes, that's the idea. I'm not saying
ideal. That's an ideal, right?
Did you say idea? Platonist ideals, that's literally idea. Where it comes from, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, you can, you know, you look at freshman physics in college and, you know, they take out all the tough pieces, like, you know, let's ignore air resistance for this ballistics problem, right? So yes, that's an ideal and never attainable by definition.
Not perfectly attainable, but it's clear that there are some people that are far more moral than most of us. You look at the Nelson Mandelas, the Gandhis, and those kind of, you know, moral elites, and you would be like, yeah, you know, I think I would trust that guy to make decisions for 300 million people.
Yeah, ultimately, as humans, you have to decide that, right? And I was arguing that that decision resides with an individual as opposed to, you know, with... you know, if I'm going to trust the leader, then I want to hear what the leader has to say, right?
And you just don't want to, don't trust the corporate elite. Is that it? Like, you don't trust a corporate or a business or political group to be in between you?
I think in business, you make the assumption that, you know, a company has one goal.
Right, always. Which is immoral, by the way.
No, I don't think it's immoral to make a profit. I think that's completely moral.
That's to me, that's a cover phrase for, it's like people say, you always hear the mobsters in the movies say, I did this for my family. You know, I was killing other families, other people for my family.
To me, that's a very human, and I think.
That's a single winner system. Like I always talk about in moral equivalency, like in persuasion, if you win and other people lose, that means you lost.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you on that. I was thinking more about the, you know, how did, you know, so you mentioned, you said Gandhi, you said,
Mandela.
You mentioned Mandela, Martin Luther King. And these are people that are, you know, absolutely incredible and, you know, on many different fronts, right? And I think those are spectacular examples and altruistic, right? I mean, those, you can say they are good examples, right? There's a bunch of folks that are often bandied about in those same groups that I think don't meet those requirements,
sure.
Right? And so with business, I understand and I know, and I told you a while back, I had trouble with the idea that I was going into sales because I thought sales were just transactional and about getting the money. And Sure, they are. But if you're, you know that going in, right? Somebody's got something to sell you. They're trying to convince you to buy it. Now, you got to figure out if you trust them. But that's, again, back to an individual's decision to trust or not trust, as opposed to something where let me see. The elite say I should trust Dan French, so I'm going to trust him. No, I trust you because I've gotten to know you.
Sure. But the moral, what if the moral elite said to trust me? What if Condi was like, that guy, Dan French, you can trust him.
I would suspect immediately that there was something going on.
Why would you not trust Gandhi?
Well, I haven't had a chance to talk to Gandhi about you.
Doesn't he get a moral carte blanche? Like, he just, anything he suggests is probably, it's probably a good recommendation.
Well, carte blanche and probably are different, right? So I would say
highly likely, 99%, whatever you need to threshold you need.
Yeah, there's a small number of people in that space for me. You know, everybody else is trust but verify.
Yeah, that's a nice, safe, much safer, version of the world. It's very hard to verify these days. Like, as you've said, everything comes to us. The digital world is miraculous with the information that it gives you access to. But between you and that information is this whole invisible architecture, minefield, battleground that compromises it before you get there and before it gets to you. And that's what people don't really ever get the training to. They end up not trusting it, and they'll attack the media because it lives in the middle of that space. They'll attack, the social media companies like you're talking about because it lives in the middle of the space. But anybody in that space is going to get attacked because they're not morally elite enough. They're corrupted in some way.
Well, my assumption is everybody's corrupt.
Well, journalism tries to avoid that. That's the whole, eventually the whole nature of journalism was to evolve to the point where, things like the Jefferson, people being able to run their own presses early in the country, and then with yellow journalism and the Hearst, and all that kind of early, clearly biased, viable journalism. That's why it turned to, we need to really push these ideas of training people to try to be as impartial as they can be, to try to be as objective, to try to make sure that you check the evidence. All the rules of journalism are just there as reactions to these horrible, types of media, which is what Trump says they still are. So journalism's tried to create a moral space for itself, and it's not perfect, but it clearly, I have a journalism undergrad, and they pound you with ethics, so they try to carve that space for themselves. And then Trump came along and completely, corrupted that space. It's like, there's nothing about you that's, objective. There's zero.
That's one way to describe it. That's one way to describe it. He may have just shined a light on him.
He may have. I mean, that's what he's claiming.
He's got an agenda. Absolutely.
But we know by, experience with Trump that he amplifies almost everything that he talks about, like he's doing with the election fraud right now. Right. I call this building a shit mountain. If you say enough bad things and you just say them over and over, and you say many versions of them until you get a pile big enough that people can't see around, then that becomes kind of a version of reality.
It is. It is. But so let me back you up a little bit. There was the journalists are or are not working for for-profit companies.
Well, I think the tradition, before the conglomerations and stuff under Reagan, right, was these family owned, Boston Globe, the Spotlight movie, where they come in and they're like, we have a, this is about the people of Boston. That's who we work for. We don't work for a corporation.
Yeah.
And you saw that shift in the 80s, with the deregulation and the end of, a lot of those sort of very powerful, usually family owned media entities. And it changed journalism for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think you could say the same thing about the church, right? The Catholic Church changed Christianity in shocking ways. And it's also, love it or hate it, it's also been one of the reasons that Christianity is still around, right? It's, you think of the church as sort of a way to communicate forward through time. Important messages, right? Believe or don't believe. I think you'd have to put Jesus in your list of guys like Gandhi and
seems like he got into moral elite status.
I think he did.
They've kind of changed him these days. Like I saw a meme with him the other day online holding a machine gun.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm not sure Jesus would have been gun friendly.
I'm glad I live in a country where you could do that. And I'm glad that there aren't at least obviously as many people in that's, you know, that would be willing to go blow up a newspaper or blow up a social media or whatever, because they publish the, Jesus with a machine gun. But if you live in France and you publish, you know, something about Muhammad, you can get blown up.
Yeah, that would probably happen here too if we did it regularly enough.
Yeah, hope not.
I don't know. So let's go back to where you were getting to. Like we were talking about the history of journalism, you know, trying to create a moral space for itself. And then Trump coming in and being like, no, you guys are a latrine. Let me show everybody.
Yeah. Well,
you seem to be on the latrine side. You're like, you seem to be like, oh yeah, this whole thing is just a massive swamp.
Using a lot of trigger words here for me.
I'm feeling
triggered.
Where do these triggers come from? It's kind of
isn't a safe space for me anymore. I think the important part for me there is that I don't have, you know, a spot in time where I can say the media was altruistic and the media or journalists, and I mean media like I was talking about, persuasive pamphlets and, local newspapers in Jefferson's time, right? I mean, I think, I don't think there was a point when the media ever, you know, got to that ideal. And I think that in my life, I used to read the business section of the paper and the sports section, because the front page just, you know, and I mean, like, you know, when I moved to Houston, right, the Houston Chronicle, that's not thought of as a incredibly liberal paper, but I, at the time, felt like the front page was hard to read. And because it was so biased, right? And so the idea that Trump has created, you know, the media as a straw man, as a boogeyman, well, that he's playing to his base, and I would expect him to do exactly that, right? But I don't think that the media has suddenly gotten bad. I think the media has been biased. I mean, when we had four channels on TV when I was a kid, right? There was ABC, CBS, NBC, and PBS. There was not a spectrum of political thought then, right?
No, there wasn't. I mean, people don't look at Walter Cronkite and go, that guy was corrupted. Yeah.
Well, I think, but also
liberal bias.
Yeah. Walter Cronkite was also, one of the guys that made Vietnam into a Walter Nixon, a Nixon thing, right? And I think Walter Cronkite, if he was doing a service, would have been clear that this was Kennedy's war, and it was a war that Johnson threw incredible money to his buddies in Texas, to build airfields and rebuild airfields. And, to me, the idea that Walter Cronkite is any less biased than, pick your favorite MSNBC, host today. It's not a premise that I can buy into.
Really? So you see Walter Cronkite as a liberal wonk, like just a facade for the liberal view of politics?
I think journalism tends to attract people that are more on the control side of the spectrum as opposed to the liberty side of the spectrum. And so it is sort of by nature that way. And I think, by the way, Fox, which everybody has, gotten all, everybody, the regular media, the not Fox media is all pissed off about. I think you look at Rupert Murdoch, who's one of the most incredible businessmen of the century, right? He saw the opportunity presented by, everybody, all the companies that were in the media space being kind of at one end of that spectrum. And he said, oh, there's an opportunity for me to create something here that sells because it's not those things, right? And so I tend to look.
That's an interesting history of Rupert Murdoch that you just told.
One, he's a businessman. I know he's out to make money. I'm starting there, right?
Yep. I think everybody would give you that. He's definitely a businessman.
Fox in the U.S., Fox News or Fox, you know, the Fox News Network. He didn't create that out of altruism. He created it because he thought he could make some money, right?
So let's stop right. Okay. So I'll give you the first premise. Clearly, okay. He's a business guy. He likes money.
Yeah.
The second, that he created that to make money. I think that's partially true. Clearly, he likes to make money, but he's also a clear ideologue, right? Like, he did that along an ideology. Are you saying that was just a soulless, profit-oriented choice, or that, you know, he saw, like, because there was a whole, you know, there was a whole ideological mechanism in place to allow him to do that. Like, Reagan made him a U.S. citizen, like fast-tracked him to U.S. citizenship so that he could own media.
Yeah.
You know, that's clearly a collusion with the conservative political machine.
Okay.
So how much of what he did was to make money and how much of it was to get a new, you know, an ideology he preferred more amplified into the world?
I would say I know very little about Rupert Murdoch's ideology. I haven't read any, you know, books that he's written. I haven't, you know, I've read some editorial stuff that he's done personally, but I know very little about his ideology. So I don't know if I could say one way or another. I would say, you know, my reasoning for saying, hey, this is why he did it, I don't think you can argue with that he did it for profit.
Partially, I would definitely agree that that was one of his reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think that's, do you think the guys that run Disney, which owns ABC, you know, the guys that run NBC or run CBS are any different than that?
I don't know how to compare those exactly. Like, I know a little bit of the history of Rupert Murdoch, and, you know, there are different ways of gathering information about people. So if we're doing this inductively, where we're looking at all the evidence and then inferring back to his beliefs versus deductively, which is here are his beliefs, and then they, you know, play out into the examples. Inductively, everything he's backed essentially at that station, you know, was very hyper conservative, almost far right doctrine.
I don't have any ammunition to argue that point.
I it doesn't matter to me. It's just when I look at it and go, when I see the change in the media landscape, which gets people to the point like where you're at, and I think you're very typical with a lot of people, a lot of thinkers especially, who have accepted the premise that the media is biased. And ergo, you know, when there are other things that come up that contradict that, that can often be a good thing, or it may be just a profit-driven thing. But that idea of the media bias is a very complicated idea, but people end up in a fairly simple spot on it. And that's one of the things rhetorically that is dangerous. Like, I always call it, you know, really strong conclusions from really dicey information.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I gotcha. I agree with that.
And so sometimes when I hear the conclusion, you know, the concluding statements of things like media is biased, yeah, I always want to go back in and unpack it with people and see if I can go, okay, yeah, that's a true statement, but it's also a false statement. So let's see if we can unpack it and get a little more sophisticated about it.
Okay. This is a statement. I'm not saying it's false. I'm not going with you that it's false, but let's unpack it. Teach me.
Yeah. So that would be, you know, and again, that's where it should be. Like, once you should reach conclusions because you thought about something and you saw evidence and it makes sense to you, and you get to a position, you're like, okay, I'm comfortable with that. Okay. And that's my belief.
Not because somebody told me I should.
Yeah, but you got information from somebody, you know, it came from somewhere. You didn't just make all this up in your mind about the media.
Agree.
You know, we typically end up at beliefs and forget where we got them.
I think that's a human condition.
Yeah. And especially in an information age like this, when you just can't track it all, there's just far too much. But when I see super strong claims, that's why I called a straw man from Trump. He didn't come up with this. That was a think tank point, you know, to attack the media. It's done again in, you know, Russia. It's done across totalitarian regimes. They always go after the media. They say the exact same things, fake news, like that. He didn't make up that phrase. That was all handed down from a communication structure through a think tank system. And, you know, that's great. That's a very sophisticated way of doing communication. You know, we have an ideology. We want to get into the world. We want to get people to vote and think a certain way. Everybody should do that. Like the left should do that far more than they do. The left is not organized the way the right is. So I admire it from a communication perspective. But when I see the outcomes of script popping up in people's minds as concluded belief, then I'm like, okay, well, let's just go backwards and show me how you got there.
Yeah. I think that kind of, that approach, you know, that disciplined academic approach is incredible and it's awesome. And I think that is what needs to be taught, you know, in terms of journalism, right? But I would argue that, you know, that's an ideal, I guess, right? And we're not, you know, we could be much closer, right? The right left bit is absolutely and completely a rhetorical tool, right?
Oh, sure, for sure. Yeah,
I think that. You know, let's play a little game here, and I'll pick some people, and you tell me right or left.
Okay.
Adolf Hitler.
Are you talking about his early policies or his late policies?
Where did he come from?
Because he grabbed a bunch of, you know, sort of the social democracy stuff. You know, early on, the workers, you know, he was in the Communist Party for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right or left?
I think he ended up on the right.
Yeah. See, I think he's on the right when he was evil. And he was on the left when he was altruistic.
So are you saying those are arbitrary assignments, you know, terms that people just assigned to him?
Yes.
So again, this is sort of deductive versus inductive. Inductive, I'm gathering evidence about what he is and I'm making a conclusion. You're saying we applied deductively right and left or altruistic and evil and just arbitrarily apply it at some point. I would look at his later policies about, you know, war and, you know, all the systematic elimination of enemies and things like that as incredibly right wing.
Yeah. And I would say those are incredibly evil and totalitarianist. But I don't think right is ever where you'd put the National Socialist Party, right? That's what Nazi is an acronym for, the National Socialist Party.
Sure.
Right? Should we go right or left? I mean, I don't think right or left is informative for an intelligent discussion.
Well, that term, this is a real problem in all of these discussions. Our terminology is not sophisticated enough, like socialist. The fact that, you know, Trump last week tweeted that the left is trying to turn this into a communist country. The fact that those terms are still being, you know, slapped around. McCarthyism was in the 40s was, you know, communism. And like that term still has that kind of usefulness. It's amazing. And socialist, like, you know, they talk about supposedly a lot of the Latino vote in this election went back towards Trump because the Democrats were seen as socialists and they see socialists as, you know, Cuba and repression.
Absolutely.
But that's not the idea of American social democracy, socialism.
Well, socialism to me is socialism, right? And it's every time we've tried socialism in a big way, tens of millions of people have died every single time.
But that, again, this is why I said like the challenge a lot of times from a communication and rhetorician perspective is the terminology is not complicated or complex enough to handle the discussion, right? So I think in America, most people think of socialism, they think of, you know, Social Security, making sure there's some money for old people when they get old.
Maybe.
How's that going to kill off millions of people?
How is it? It seems like every time we've tried it, it has. That was my claim. And, you know, you look at
We've been running it since FDR, right?
Well, FDR, there's a perfect example. You know, he thought Stalin was a great guy, right? You go read about, you know, the things he told his wife when he was, you know, after he'd gotten done meeting Stalin, he thought Stalin was an amazing guy.
He probably was an amazing guy. Anybody who gets to that point anywhere has some amazement in them.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But a good guy, you know, a good, you know, somebody we should copy, right? I mean, that's sort of where Social Security came from. Right?
Do you know what Hitler named his train?
No.
This is the best piece of trivia ever. Nobody ever gets it. I call it the most unguessable piece of historical trivia. He had a super train built because he didn't like planes. So he had new railroads built just for him. And he just went around the country in this super reinforced train.
Yes.
And his name for it was America.
Why was that?
Well, again, this is all historical, you know, biography that I read. But it was theoretically because he admired the way we dealt with our native population, the Native Americans, that we... And, you know, again, who knows anecdotally, but that was one of his models for dealing with the Jews, was that if you have a difficult population and they don't fit, you know, with the way you want to run the country, you need to get rid of them and you can't deport them. So this is a more useful way of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He called his train America. I love that piece of trivia.
I didn't know that. I'm going to use that now. And I definitely learned something here talking with you, as I always do, Dan.
Yeah, that's a great one. Well, I don't want to keep you too long. We've been talking for about an hour. And for most people, I invite them to circle back around in about a month because there's just so much to unpack. You know, I think I would really like to learn more about, you know, you being triggered by the terminology. And I think you're absolutely right. Your instincts about the right versus the left and how we assign value to people based on these very clumsy terms, it's problematic, you know, and it ends up where people can't make good political decisions about themselves and policies and what they want in the world because they literally can't even describe it well.
Yeah.
And I think you have, you know, enough learning and you do enough deep diving on your own that you have, you know, things at your disposal to think about these things with, even with history, that give you some more complicated and complex ways of viewing them. And that stuff's great. Just most people don't do it.
Yeah, I think it's important to be a lifelong learner, right? And learning on your own for your own reasons, right? About things that you're passionate about. And to me, that's, you know, being a dad, that's one of the biggest challenges is to teach that, you know, you've got to be learning, you got to be listening, you got to be paying attention. You're not always going to have, you know, drawn the best conclusion or the right conclusion. Sometimes you're in a spot where you have to make a decision. And when you do, you try and, you know, make it on the best available data.
Yeah. And I think there's a history of, I don't know how much of this you read, but there's a strand of journalism, of intellectual journalism, you know, even academic level intellectual journalism that you would find really useful because it does go much deeper into these issues with a much, you know, broader, more expansive view of them than what we get through the entertainment journalism, which is what we have now. It's all entertainment journalism. It can't do what you're doing.
It's what sells. The entertainment.
Well, yeah, because entertainment, it's what we've all been trained to. It's a consumption culture. It moves fast. Nobody's got the time to read, you know, that book that you've pulled out a few times when we've talked. And I've thought, oh, that's interesting. I'd like to look at that. And then I'm like, oh, look at this other stack of things. That
Absolutely.
But you're going back to an intellectualized source. And print is able to handle very complicated arguments and long, you know, tail discussions about things like that. And when you do that, it gives you a very different, you know, perspective on everything. So I admire that when I see somebody doing it.
Well, thanks. I have learned a lot working with you and getting an appreciation for the science of persuasion. You know, I got an electrical engineering degree, right? I had one. I think I've told you I had one philosophy class. You know, in 135 credit hours, right? 3-hour class. I wish I'd done more of that. And I've often said that if I if I were to hit lotto, I'd go get a PhD and I'd do it in history.
And kind of like you were saying earlier, this is maybe, you know, one of the things we'll finish on this because it kind of wraps it up. To me, the idea of elite is people that have had the time to actually get trained in things before they go and start trying to use their brain to do those things. So politics, nobody's got training in politics.
No.
Nobody's got training in rhetoric and persuasion. And yet everybody is sitting there doing their politics and doing their persuasion on themselves and everything else with no training in it. So
yeah.
The idea that it's going to come out well is a little suspect, you know, especially in complicated systems. So
yeah, well, I completely agree with that. I just assume though that we keep the ideal of American politics and that you're better off deciding for yourself than having the king decide for you far away. And I as long as I get a chance to, you know, decide and talk about it and not get, you know, in trouble for my views, then I'm good with that.
Yeah. And that's all that great democratic tradition, right? Of, you know, the good parts of that of empowering people. And I never want to take that away. I just also want people when they're empowered to have access to the training to let them do it well. So I don't have to watch them make kind of suspect decisions that, yeah, you know, end up undermining the very democracy that it let them make suspect decisions.
Well, yeah, but that's what I admire about what you're doing with Rhetoric Warriors and, you know, the great, you know, plug for your, you know, your newsletter and your podcast. That it's great to kind of learn. It's great for me to learn about those tools as a more of a science than as, you know, a blunt instrument or, you know, just a tool that I've grabbed because I, you know, I need a screwdriver. So I grab a screwdriver, but to learn more about the science of persuasion has been really, you know, amazing for me. So thanks for that.
Sure, man. I appreciate it. Man, I appreciate your time. Enjoyed the conversation. This was awesome. I will swing back around and drag you in again at some point.
I'm glad to do it. I'm glad to do it anytime. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tom.
Adios.